I'll bet you when you hear this term, circumstantial evidence, you're like, ah, that's just junk. You know, you hear on TV all the time, all they have is a circumstantial case. Well, that's all I ever have.
Only 15% of murder convictions result from eyewitness testimony. What indirect evidence persuades a jury to convict the other 85% beyond a reasonable doubt? No one strand of circumstantial evidence can convict a murder suspect. How does a homicide detective weave multiple strands together? We'll answer on today's Truth in the Test Tube. You may have seen him on TV on NBC's Dateline. J. Warner Wallace is nationally famous for his expertise in solving cold cases, crime cases that other detectives have abandoned.
In February, Wallace spoke at the Purpose Church in Pomona, California, as part of the Wisdom and Evangelism Conference. Here's the first half of his presentation, How to Make the Case Like a Detective.
My background is working investigations, working cold case murders. As you know, murders have no statute of limitations. So we can come back to those years later, even if they're unsolved. And my cases are from about 1979 to 1988. If you like Dateline, you've probably seen some of these cases we're going to talk about, because I think I've been on Dateline more than anybody else in the country. And it's only because our agency is so close to NBC Universal, okay? So we get a chance to hang out with these guys. My son is now doing the same job that I did for years. We're like the George Foreman of law enforcement. You know, George has got six boys, and they're all named George Foreman. So we have the same name. In the last 55 years, if you've called our agency and asked for Jim Wallace, there's been somebody there to answer the phone. And you learn a few things over those years. And so this morning, what we're going to do is just take a look at how to make the case for what we believe like a detective. And rather than give you a set of facts, I wanted to show you some basic rules of evidence that people don't usually talk about, but we have to employ in order to make a case. Now, we just got done talking about Richard Dawkins. Here's something that he said that I always resonated with as an atheist, because I didn't become a Christian until I was 35. He says, many of us saw religion as harmless nonsense. Beliefs might lack all supporting evidence, but we thought if people needed a crutch for consolation, where's the harm? September 11th changed all that. And I would have agreed. Because I would have said, of all the people I know who are Christians, the cops I know who have a very high skill level, they want to make a case for why a certain guy is guilty of a crime. They can give you five reasons why that guy is guilty, but you ask them to give me five reasons why I should trust the Bible, they couldn't do it. I thought, really? So you're really evidential in your professional work, but you're not evidential when it comes to your metaphysical life. That bothered me. But what it really came down to is knowing what counts as evidence to begin with. You know, I was an atheist until I was about maybe 10 years on the job. And during those 10 years on the job, I started to learn about the role of evidence and the rules of evidence. So although someone like Dawkins would say, like, you guys don't really have anything other than these crazy arguments you guys make, the cosmological argument, the axiological argument. Hey, you guys don't have any direct, hard, physical, forensic, testable evidence to make your case. Well, I'll be honest with you. I've worked now cold cases for years, about a dozen years, and I can tell you that my cases are not built this way. Do we even think that Richard or anyone else really has an idea of what counts as evidence to begin with? And do we have that kind of evidence as Christians, and how we make a case with it? So what we want to talk about this morning is what counts as evidence, what is all of the rules of evidence, and if you understood the rules of evidence, maybe you could make the case easier to your friends. Because before you can assess evidence, you have to understand what the rules are that help us to assess the evidence. Does that make sense? So I want to share with you some things that I've learned, stuff I've learned about evidence that I learned before I started looking at the evidence for Christianity. First thing I learned about evidence is simply this. Everything is evidence. Hear me on that. When I walk into a crime scene, I know that everything counts as evidence. Sometimes I'm looking at, you know, just forensic physical evidence. But there's lots of stuff in the room that's not physical. Lots of parts of the case that aren't physical, those also count. I don't need physical evidence to make a case. I've got a couple of cases that I didn't have a single piece of physical evidence, yet we still convicted our guy. You also, there's times when, you know, where the victim is attacked is important to me. But also where he could have been attacked but wasn't is important to me. Starting to see a pattern here? You know, what was discovered at the crime scene, that could be important. What's not discovered, what's missing from the crime scene is important. I will hold against you everything you say in an interview. But I will also hold against you everything you could have said but didn't. So what you failed to say is just as important. And whatever you did, that's going to be important. What you could have done but failed to do is also... Do you see the pattern here? It's the is and the is nots. Brothers and sisters, I'm here to tell you that if you think we're going to have to make a case based on certain forms of evidence, and if we don't have those forms of evidence, we can't make a case, you're wrong. Everything counts as evidence. Make sense? Second thing I learned is that there really are two forms that everything falls into. The first one is pretty simple. It's what we call direct evidence. The other one is what we call indirect evidence. Not really hard to imagine those two different kinds, right? Direct evidence is eyewitness testimony. That's all that counts as direct evidence. Indirect evidence is everything else. The DNA at the crime scene, that's not direct evidence. That's indirect evidence. Witnesses who can tell you what they saw the suspect do, that is direct eyewitness testimony. Now, sometimes we use a different word for this indirect evidence. We call this circumstantial evidence. So these are the two groups. And I'll bet you when you hear this term, circumstantial evidence, you're like, ah, that's just junk. You know, you hear on TV all the time, all they have is a circumstantial case, right? Well, that's all I ever have. I work cold cases. They went cold for a reason. There's no eyewitnesses. So when I get a case to begin with, it's terrible. It's a mess. And it's built on circumstantial evidence. As a matter of fact, judges tell juries all the time that they are not to consider circumstantial evidence as being any less valuable than direct evidence. They are to be given the exact same weight in your jury deliberations. So stop saying it's just a circumstantial case, because that means there's something less about no, it's a circumstantial case. But it's not just a circumstantial case. Does that make sense? Here's what judges tell juries in jury trials before they start the deliberations. Both direct and circumstantial evidence are acceptable types of evidence to prove or disprove the elements of a charge, including intent and mental state and acts necessary to a conviction. And neither is necessarily more reliable than the other. Neither is entitled to any greater weight than the other. So I'm here to tell you guys, we build cases about the existence of God that could be described as circumstantial. No kidding. That's how we do cases, and probably 85% of cases in America are entirely circumstantial. That's how we build cases. Don't let anyone tell you you've got to have a direct witness you can interview in order to believe something is true. Be ready to kiss down all of history then. You couldn't even know anything about your own great-grandparents if you had to have somebody alive who could say, I saw them do this. No, you're taking it on the strength of somebody else's testimony. You have to make these cases circumstantially. So just know that that's an entirely appropriate way to make a case. That's okay. Something else I learned about evidence. There's a big difference between what is possible and what is reasonable. Anything is possible. We don't even count possible. Possible doesn't matter to me in a jury trial. How do you even know you're here? You could be oversleeping right now. You could be in a dream state right now, dreaming about being here this morning. And if you think, well, I can test that, I can ask the person next to me, or I can pinch myself, that could just be part of your dream. At least admit it's possible you're just dreaming all this. But it's not reasonable. Anything is possible, but not everything is reasonable. And that's why, folks, our jury standard, the standard of proof in the most difficult criminal trials, is not beyond a possible doubt. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. Why? Because if it was beyond a possible doubt, you'd never convict anybody. You'll always have some possible doubts, but reasonable doubts are things that are grounded in evidence. You're not to speculate during jury deliberation about possibilities. You're just to infer reasonably from evidences. That brings me to something else I want to talk about. Every case has unanswered questions. I've never worked a case that I could prove beyond a possible doubt. That's not the standard, because you're always going to have some possible doubts. Always. Because you could dream of all kinds of imaginary possibilities to answer a question. But those don't count. Here's a case from about 1981. This man killed his wife and got rid of her body and then told us in 1981 that she had run off. And we believed it. We took a missing persons report. We didn't work it as a homicide until 1987. 6 years later, there wasn't a single piece of physical evidence. I couldn't tell you how he killed her, where he killed her, what he did with her body. I couldn't tell you any of that stuff. I couldn't tell you how he moved her car. All the jury had about 5 or 6 key, important, unanswered questions. They convicted this guy in about 4 hours because on the strength, basically, of his changing story over time. But no one believed us. Keith Morrison at Dateline, the first question out of his mouth was, Jim, why do you think this is the guy? I don't think he's the guy. You don't got any physical evidence. You've got very little on this case. No one believed us. His family, of course, didn't believe he was guilty. The victim's family loved this guy like a son-in-law. They didn't want to believe he was guilty either. But at the sentencing, he confessed to all of us and gave us the location of the body. You're able to convict somebody even with huge unanswered questions because you don't have to answer every question. You'll never answer every question. I'm here to tell you, brothers and sisters, you are going to hold a view called Christianity for which you cannot answer every question. That's okay. That's the nature of every worldview, is built on some unanswered questions. The question really is, how big and significant are ours compared to the other worldviews? I think we get a lot closer and we shrink the gap of unanswered questions more than anybody else. But just keep in mind, we have a jury instruction for this. It says the evidence need not eliminate all possible doubt because everything in life is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. This is what we tell jurors. If this is good enough to decide whether someone's going to go to jail or be executed, it's good enough for you to make a decision about a worldview. You cannot eliminate all possible doubts. Something else I learned, I want to finish with this today, and that is the cumulative nature of evidence. The more cumulative the case, the more robust the collection of evidence is, the stronger the inference. Now, in Cold Case Christianity, a book I wrote, I talk about this particular murder scene in which I've got a guy who's been accused of murdering his girlfriend with this baseball bat. As I assemble a case entirely circumstantial from 8 important pieces of evidence, a baseball bat that he's bleached, a lie about his alibi. He's already talked about beating his girlfriend in the past, and on the day of the murder, he actually threatened to kill her. And he's got a pair of shoes that were seen by a witness. There are like only 30 in the entire county even exist. And he's driving a car. Only 1 or 2 cars like this exist in the entire county. This case is an entirely circumstantial case that is built cumulatively. The more pieces I have, the better it would be. I probably would never go into trial with an 8-piece case. Usually my case is around 80 pieces. I call this death by 1,000 paper cuts. Because the more we have, the more obvious the inference. He's either incredibly unlucky, and these things just happen to align perfectly to make him look guilty, or he's just incredibly guilty because he is the one common causal factor that unifies all the evidence set. I'm looking for common causal factors. Make sense?
Yes, that makes perfect sense. We want to thank Detective J. Warner Wallace, The Purpose Church in Pomona, California, and the Reasons to Believe organization for permission to share this with you. Mr. Wallace will conclude his presentation on how to make the case like a detective next time. Meanwhile, you may want to explore his website, Cold Case Christianity.
You may also want to look into Detective Wallace's 2 books, Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. Thanks for joining us today. There's a handy icon to connect to us, or use our email address, truthtest@truthinthetesttube.org. That's truthtest@truthinthetesttube.org. And join us again for Truth in the Test Tube.